On one theme that ran through all the discussions, and which I think economics and other scientific areas have not dealt with, certainly social sciences haven't, and I don't think the physics and other characters have really worried about it, and maybe the biologists have. And this is the notion, I think Nouriel used the word party pooper, which is the one I've used often, is that, and Eric referred to as being on the periphery, and Nassim has been there, I suppose, in that sense. You're standing there and saying this was going to be a problem, and you're ignored. After the problem has occurred, and this certainly has occurred in Washington setting, the same people who did not see a problem are running our Treasury Department. They're running most of the banks. Ben was not, Bernanke was not was not responsible in the same way that Greenspan was, but certainly it comes out of a certain crowd. If that is some sort of a law of society, that what happens is I'm part of the central group of people responsible for the problem, but then when the problem occurs, I am reappointed, or my friends or colleagues are appointed. I think a big issue is how to strengthen the groups that are either on the periphery or are outside the mainstream who turn out to be right. We seem not to have a system that readily takes the people who are yelling about the troubles and bringing them into the central discourse. And so issues about that.
Yeah. Yeah, Richard, you're an optimistic fellow. You sound
really.
You're optimistic and rational. Let me tell you what I did. Is I thought that automatically that we'd have a crisis, that they would probably go to Harvard Business School, remove Bob Merton, go to places and start removing these people, or put them somewhere, and that's it. And after the crisis, I thought that would happen. Till now, I've been involved in the history of medicine, reading the history of medicine. And it's depressing. It took 280 years between the discovery that bleeding you triples your chance of death if you have, they used to bleed, right? Triples the chance of death if you have pneumonia to implementation. 280 years. Okay. Even if you ate healthy, you won't live that long, all right? So it took, if you take the history of medicine, anesthesia was discovered, so on, why should I do it? So history of medicine, even now, there's a paper in Science on translational gap between knowledge and translational gap, they call it. The average now of the past 50 years is 25 years. So it's not like suddenly. So what you have to do here is wait for funerals, okay? Or something like that, or unless you can trigger funerals, I'm sure. But I'm not advocating stuff the other sort. But
that's a good May Day suggestion.
All right, but you
empirically.
Empirically, let's not be too hopeful.
I would just we may not be too hopeful, but there are other examples where things moved faster. There's the case of the pumps in Britain when people were dying in the sort of a form of plague, and they found out which pumps and which areas the water came from.
Cholera.
Yes, thank you. I didn't know that. And that was pretty quickly dealt with. So I'm sure we have both we have the examples on the bad tail, and we have a few examples on the good tail. And I suppose the question is, how do you learn what to do to speed up the average 25 years and to work on that good tail? I think that's a critical thing for scientific research, is how we can speed up this change of minds. It may be we don't have to kill the guys, but we could retire them perhaps, and not retire them with great rewards. At a conference I was just at, the question came about, let's assume that the critical views that you've heard here are correct about adding more and more debt to the government and so on and so forth. And that indeed this will make our getting out of this crisis possibly worse. There are some bad decisions being made. I then said, well, what do you think is going to happen to Tim Geithner and Larry Summers in this case? And I said, well, they'll be fired, and yes, they'll lose their jobs. Do you think they will go to the homeless state? No. Somewhere the system will pick them up and they'll be paid more than anyone in this room. That happens. Then I said, well, what happens if they turn out to be right? And we really get out of this recession in the ways that they presumably hope that we will. In a year or two from now, they also will be out of a job, and they will be also paid extremely highly, hopefully more than this. They're a failure. But there is a built-in thing in the system of protecting the certain set of folks, and it seems to me that's missing completely from any Arrow de Brew analysis, any kind of economic modeling, which and I think that's a real weakness of what we've done. But I want to be completely critical that we just take it as given and we can't somehow learn some more and squeeze that process.
I guess my reaction is, if only we could get someone prominent, like a Harvard economics professor, to ask a question like that in a room with a former CFO of Microsoft, perhaps one of the leading evolutionary biologists in the country, and I don't want to say Dr. Doom, Dr. Predictive Power, on a webcast so that people could pick up that question and run with it, we might actually get somewhere. I think that one of the great things about asking that question is maybe this is happening right now, and maybe there is new technology in the web, in all of this new media. I see John Brockman twittering about what's going on here, not knowing what his reach is through the edge, probably with the best Rolodex in the country. All sorts of things are possible, and all sorts of things can happen. One of the most remarkable things, I've more or less tried to keep a low profile as best I can for the last, I don't know, 20 years, because it hasn't been a very safe environment to talk. And finally we have, in the United States at least, a president who openly calls for non-believers to be brought into the big tent, and people are singing Woody Guthrie songs with verses about private property, which was previously associated with communism. We're at the beginning of some very hopeful period, perhaps, and I think that these questions are good ones, but let's not make the mistake of imagining that the distribution that governed us during the Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Reagan years is the distribution governing us now. I think that maybe what we're looking at is a very fat tail, and I see Neil Turek nodding away, who I heard a rumor was white ANC and grew up in Tanzania because South Africa was under apartheid. There's tremendous hope here. It's just that we've been through a generation of a very low-intensity sort of McCarthy era, where instead of the House Un-American Activities Committee in the United States, we've had Fox News, we've had Lee Atwater. It's been very intimidating to speak up. Things have changed. We are all gambling to some extent, that things are going to be different. I'll be very curious to see what comes of this conference and whether we have more of them like this afterwards. Who knows who's listening?
Is the Washington kind of characters now, do they talk to you regularly?
Well, you know, I spent 3 days in Washington, Friday through Sunday, at the IMF meetings, and I spoke with tons of policymakers, even senior ones. But I think, you know, it's not a question of if people listen to me and whatever. You know, I could talk to Larry Summers, Tim Geithner every day, but I think you have to look at the fundamentals of what's happening. There's something much more complex that's not to do with any specific individuals, you know. And the fundamentals are, you know, open question, is there so much regulatory capture that even after such a severe financial crisis, nothing has changed? I think that's an open question because, you know, the kind of more pessimistic interpretation is, you know, we privatize the gains coming from reckless lending, investing, and you name it, and now we're socializing in the losses. If you think about it, the government's already committed $12.8 trillion of financial support to the financial system between guarantees, liquidity, insurance, recapitalization. Out of that $12.8 trillion, around $3 trillion has already been dispersed. So one way of interpreting is to say, nothing has changed. Now Goldman Sachs wants to give the money back and go back to no limits on compensation and do the same reckless stuff. And the banks have a provision for bonuses for the last quarter alone as much as they were doing a year ago in spite of this mess. So one pessimistic interpretation is, you know, the power of the lobbies and the power of Wall Street is such that we're not going to do the right reforms. We're going to go back to business as usual after having bailed out. And once the economy recovers and once financial markets are recovering, people are going to forget. You know, same thing happened after the East Asian crisis and after LTCM, there were minor suggestions about, say, registering hedge funds and things that were basics, and nothing was done once we got out of that crisis and went to the next bubble. But I think there is the reason for being maybe slightly more optimistic is that, you know, this financial crisis in terms of its costs is much more severe than anything has happened since the Great Depression. You know, think of it, about $50 trillion of global equity market wealth destroyed, about $20 trillion of housing wealth destroyed, two-thirds of it in the United States. You know, 5 million jobs lost in the U.S. just in the first year, more than the previous recession. We're going to be 10 million by the end of this recession, 50 million people globally in below the poverty line. The world being angry that the U.S. through its own reckless policies has essentially transferred all this mess to other countries, and now we have a global financial crisis and a global recession. It's not just the United States. Think about the fiscal cost. You know, the U.S. alone will increase the public debt by about $7 to $9 trillion in the next few years. Same thing in many other countries. Think about, you know, all the other social political consequences of this. So I think that this is an occasion to get the financial system right, because if we don't do it right this time around, there's already a massive backlash against globalization, against free market, against financial innovation, against free trade, there is financial protectionism, and we could go back to ugly stuff. And I think there is a fine balance. Excessive liberalization and deregulation was crazy, laissez-faire was crazy. But certainly we don't want to go in a world in which the prudent role of the government in the economy that is there is necessary, providing social safety net, public services, and prudential regulatory supervision should not become extreme, because if it becomes extreme, a world of protectionism and no free trade and other things is going to be also an ugly world based on what we saw in the 30s. So the pendulum swung in one direction, we don't want it to swing in the other one. And that's potentially is a risk if we don't manage these things right. So it gives me some hope that maybe the reforms of the system is going to be more appropriate than in the past, because the size of the crisis, the extent of it, the fiscal, financial, economic, jobs, income damage, U.S. and global, has been large enough that people are not going to say, let's go back to business. We'll be globally a pressure to do more, to have a system which finance helps the proper allocation of savings to investment. We've turned the financial system into a system of, you know, freak finance, literally, or voodoo finance, rather than something helps economic activity. It has been destructive of economic activity rather than helping productive economic activity. That cannot be the case anymore. Otherwise, there will be nasty populist backlash against markets.
I think that government officials are quite irrelevant in this for several reasons. Policymakers, I mean, they've just seen George Bush nationalize the banks.
He's a Republican.
Okay.
Tells you that it looks like they're just reacting to things. But we have the feeling that they play a larger role. I think the system is going to destroy itself because it's too fragile. And Riel mentioned that debt to GDP ratio has tripled in the last 20 years, and the way debt will destroy itself. Nouriel said it should transform itself into equity, which is a normal way to destroy debt, the old-fashioned way. But it seems to me that whatever people do, eventually the system's going to destroy itself. Okay, so we might, if we listen to Nouriel, we'd help it go where it should want to go. But I think it's going to take us there. The only problem we have is the government fighting the system in its attempt to destroy itself may either be helpless, okay, the $12 trillion that may print money, all right, either be helpless because it's very nonlinear, and at some point start trigger inflation. Once inflation is there, so it can have hyperinflation. So the rosy scenario is the system destroy itself without making the poor guy suffer too much. And the nasty scenario is, I think, the government, by fighting it, because of not doing the rational thing, will cause hyperinflation. Because let's think about it. I don't understand what's coming out of Washington. Here I hear them saying, we have too much leverage, which is right. And what banks should lend. I don't understand. The banks are 33 times leverage. What do you want it to be, 38 times leverage? All right. And then the consumer, they tell consumer, you're not saving enough. We're living on borrowed money from the future. Why don't you spend more? Okay. So I don't understand. So they seem to be so navigating like on a raft, completely controlled by the ocean, that they're doing some ad hoc things that are contradictory. So you should sit down. As I heard Nouriel once say, take the bull by the horn.
Okay, and nothing has been done. So it looks like the system will take us, will take itself by the horn and will take us wherever he wants to, which is, I think, I mean, my bet is hyperinflation beyond what we can imagine, because if you have 5% inflation, people expect the moon and gold goes to the moon, or S&P crashing to levels that will, you know, cause surprises, right? On people opening their 401k, that's what I think.
Can I ask a question, Nassim?
Yes.
When you say that, you know, the rosy scenario is one in which the system destroys itself, I mean, what do you mean? Because when there are these market failure, and we learned it in the Great Depression, and the appropriate policy action is not taken, a stock market crash becomes a Great Depression, and then the social political consequences of that lead to ugly, aggressive, authoritarian regimes coming to power. We ended up in World War II. So we cannot afford just to say the system is going to heal itself. We need to believe that appropriate policy actions can be taken and be undertaken to transform a situation that's ugly from becoming destructive in ways that are going to be really damaging.
Yeah, no, what I meant by system destroying itself is I look at nature and I see how nature works, and nature likes to break things early that are fragile, okay? And so by because the way the way I view the system and the ecological standpoint is that if we mimic nature, nothing comes big, things are fragile, destroy themselves, you see? You just want to avoid things getting too big for these to become systemic. So if I take nature, the largest animal I can find in nature is an elephant. I shoot down an elephant, has no consequence. But you have a lot of interdependence, okay? The largest, but here in finance, so you take not a very large bank, Lehman, you shoot it down, look what happens, okay? So the system will bring itself, right, should probably, you know, we'll go back to 1982 when Citibank was underwater and Continental Illinois was underwater and the government started saving banks, okay? That's what I meant. The system, let the system destroy itself in a sense. Any aberration that was showing up in 98 with LTCM should have led to automatic sizing down of that system. But the government fragilized it at higher and larger level. And that's what we want to avoid. So we'll go back to your scenario, definalize the economy. That's fine. If the government does it, it's beautiful. I doubt they'll do it. So it looks like it's going to destroy itself, you see.
If you put a little more positive statement in this, it would be, The old Wall Street system is dangerous and has proven itself, you know, to be a failure. So we're going to have to build up a new and different kind of financial system with presumably smaller institutions, so nobody is so big that they fail. How you build that in, given regulatory capture problem, becomes a serious kind of issue. Mm-hmm. But we certainly have given up in a lot of terrain antitrust policies, and one of the things that I see in this is you put these policies in, they are reducing the chance of some complete meltdown, but they're costing you some small inefficiencies as they come in. The economists in particular, some of our friends, will be out there estimating those inefficiency costs, and they'll be absolutely correct about those costs, but they don't see, this is your tail that's out there, that in fact it's almost, it is an insurance policy, like as you put it in the Bill Fung statement.
Yeah, let me come back to this inefficiency, no sort of inefficiency. Optimization by nature is done completely differently from optimization using the Bellman equation or whatever optimization you do with Lagrange multipliers. It works differently, and let me tell you why. Look at a typical example I give. You came with two lungs, no?
Yes.
Yeah, two kidneys. Well, you have one too many. It's heavy, it's inefficient, right? Why do you have two of them? Well, it's like an option. Nature loves to pay for option. Nature loves insurance. Nature loves the redundancy. So there's two redundancies. The functional redundancy, the Edelman and Galley, the function does two things. In other words, it's exactly opposite of Ricardo. Ricardo says specialize in wine or cloth. No, nature likes things, functions, to do two, three, four things. Completely, it's like you being a professor at night and a mechanic during the day or vice versa, all right? Nature likes that. nature likes some degree of slack in the system to stabilize. That's from ecology, right? Versus, so so economics, instead of changing the world to fit the economist, why don't we change economics to accept the Edelman and Galley result on functional redundancy, and stuff like that?
But I think the problem is that we don't have the discipline to think about nature in the right terms. Nature doesn't like anything. We have a variety of different strategies that come from unoccupied opportunities. The issue that I often bring up is the cheetah. If the cheetah has such fantastic land speeds, why don't all land predators have those speeds? Because the cheetah faces a problem with reserve capacity, that it's paid for that kind of speed by not carrying reserves, so that if it screws up on too many attempts, it may face a starvation problem that a more robust animal does not have. So there's simply a trade-off between reserve capacities and what Richard was calling efficiencies. I think the key problem is the language, that when somebody looks at a reserve capacity and decides that it is, quote, inefficient, they are using language to misrepresent the system. Exactly how much reserve capacity or redundancy is efficient? Why do planes crash so frequently? Because things that are absolutely critical are often supplied in redundancy. So the key issue, I think, is, and this goes back to something Nouriel was saying, we care tremendously about how we learn. If we learn through catastrophes, if we learn through wars, I want the system to break, but I want it to break in a specified way. I don't want to be devoid of markets. I don't want to be in a world that it's incapable for wealth to concentrate so that we can sit in an auditorium like the one we're sitting in. On the other hand, I don't want the regulatory capture. I certainly don't want the risk of calamities, of great utopian experiments that cost millions of lives. So the key question is to distinguish, I think, between pain and injury. Pain has a very uncomfortable treatment in economics because it is a form of disutility. There are some people who wish to anesthetize pain. I choose almost never to do so. Why? Because pain is a cheap form. It's a precursor to injury. So please, leave me with my pain and make sure that the system works. The reason that I am standing up here, or sitting down here rather, and making a pain in the ass out of myself is not to cause injury to the system, but to cause pain to the system and to get the pain to the places that need it, to light a fire under people who need a fire lit under them. And I guarantee you that when a Richard Freeman and a Nouriel Roubini start talking about Larry Summers, and people are hearing that level of criticality, because we all know how bright Larry Summers is and how great work the man can do, terrific work, right? But the fact is that we're all nervous about how he's behaving in this position. So the point here is to start adding more pain to the system to avoid injury, to break it the way Nassim wants to, but not to break it the way we did in the late 30s and through to the mid-40s.
Okay. On that note, I think we should have the opportunity of hearing questions from the audience, which is gathered here. So let's have a session. So please state for the rest of us your name and affiliation, if you like, and ask one or the whole panel. We have a microphone that will start circulating, but if you speak loudly, we can hear you.
That problem. What to do with paper money? Where we are going to go with it?
Okay, does anybody want to briefly respond?
This is exactly the reason why I have metals, including copper. Honestly, because you think of a currency without a government. As a government, if the government doesn't follow Nouriel's advice, all right, and there's a high probability of that, then you need a currency without a government. Which is gold and the other one.
But I'll take your paper currency right now if you want to give it away.
Actually, I mean, if I can add a point, of course, the risk of fiat money, as we know, is that, you can print it as much as you can. If you do so, there is not enough credibility in terms of monetary policy. Eventually, you end up with inflation or hyperinflation. But I think that governments over the last 20, 30 years have been able through a variety of ways, inflation targeting or interest rate rules, to be able to, after the high inflation of the 70s, to control their behavior. The risk right now is that with the large increase in public debts, eventually people are going to figure out it's easier, in terms of part of least resistance politically, to print money and cause inflation, reduce the real value of debt that way, rather than going to Congress, raise tax or cut spending. That's the risk of monetizing these fiscal deficits, but I don't know how large is that. But the idea that if we didn't have paper money, everything would be okay, I think is actually, it's a myth. You know, bigger boom and bust of economic activity were occurring during the gold standard, when everything was pegged to the value of gold, and gold had very sharp movements because of changes in supply and demand. And actually, even during the Great Depression, most countries, as long as they were holding to gold, were going through a very, very painful process of one, deflation, and then debt deflation. It was the repeal of the gold clause in the United States and devaluation of the dollar that then led to get us out of this mess and starting to be able to increase the money supply rather than contracting it, and therefore to stimulate the economy. So I think that those really, as gold as being the solution of all, actually are totally wrong. You know, gold is still a barbaric relic, and there is no role for it as a part of the global financial system. We have to live in a world of fiat currencies. Then there are all the political economy issues of mismanaging monetary policy, but I think that there is no better alternative so far.
I'm Barclay Rosser. I'm an economist from James Madison University. I want to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here. I think that's part of why I was brought in. Let me offer a defense of policymakers. Now, policymakers have certainly made lots of mistakes, and some of them have been pointed out: too much deregulation, overly easy monetary policy in 2003, and a whole lot of things. But there's a real problem. Some of the policymakers, in fact, really do know what's going on. And if you really do know what's going on, you have a problem. What do you do? I mean, Nouriel Hartley was one of us. I mean, Alan Greenspan, to give him credit on something, saved the world from a great recession in 1987. For 2 months prior to the crash, he was worrying about a stock market crash. He set up an emergency task force to act if there was a crash. The markets were crashing on October 20th, the next morning. They were crashing hard, and what happened? Unlike 1929, they did learn from history, the people at the New York Fed under Greenspan's orders got up and told all the brokers and the local banks, you want money, unlike 1929 when the Fed tightened, you want money, you got money, and the markets bounced at 11:30, and we did not have a great recession. Okay, in 1996, Alan Greenspan had lunch. We had the Cry Wolf problem. He had lunch with Bob Shuler. Bob Shuler told me this story. So he had lunch with, and he went out and gave a press conference. So he was talking about irrational exuberance. Now, this was when the Dow was about where it was on March 10th, which may be the bottom if we don't have another crash, which of course we might. And so after that, Alan Greenspan said, oh, I'm not going to do anything. I mean, I think Alan Greenspan said, fell into a trap because he cried wolf. And then he said, well, I'm not going to go around and cry wolf again. Now, suppose you know. I think that Bernanke really knew. I have reason to believe that. First of all, he was the deepest student of the Great Depression there is. He studied, you know, he cites Minsky, he studied what happened in 1931. I think you have a problem. And we live in a world of multiple equilibrium, and I think it's the eggshell problem. Fed central bankers cannot go out there and say scary things, because they can actually cause terrible things that might not happen otherwise. What happened on August 2007? Now you'd had, you know, one can say, oh, Bernanke's going around with all this happy talk, and maybe he shouldn't have been, maybe he should have just kept his mouth shut. Maybe that's the alternative. Just don't say anything. And some central bank, you know, Arthur Burns would cloud his head in smoke so nobody could tell what he was saying. He would testify before Congress, and some of these guys wanted to mumble, so nobody would, you know. What did Bernanke, but in August 2007, when things started to blow up, what happened? They immediately began rolling out all these alternative credit facilities. They were preparing them. They knew that there was trouble coming. Oh, okay. Anybody who wants to scare themselves should go look at the Fed balance sheet. They're doing totally wild things. I mean, I just talked to a former student who is now a staffer on the House Financial Services Committee. House Financial Services Committee wanted to have hearings on what the Fed's doing. He said, don't. Just shut up and hope it works.
Right. Okay, brief response from anybody who wants. Nouriel?
Well, you know, I think that sometimes policymakers make mistakes, and sometimes they are part of the right solutions. You know, take even somebody like Ben Bernanke. I mean, of course, in the case of Alan Greenspan, I think now people fault him for pushing down the Fed funds rate and keeping it too low for too long, and then raising it too slowly than otherwise, for believing in all this toxic underwriting. He was the biggest supporter of subprime. Things like, you know, no down payments, interest rate only, negative amortization, ninja loans, you name it. He thought that financial innovation was great. So he made many mistakes. But even take somebody like Ben Bernanke. Early on, I think that the Fed totally misdiagnosed the nature of this crisis. First of all, Bernanke was saying throughout 2007, this is just a minor housing slump. It's going to bottom out the next few months. It's not bottom out today, let alone a year ago, 2 years ago. Then he kept on saying that the problem was a niche and contained subprime problem. This was a much more generalized asset and credit bubble, subprime, near prime, prime, home equity loan lines, commercial real estate, credit cards, auto loans, student loans, leverage loans, and you name it. So that was a misdiagnosis. And three, Bernanke, the Fed, kept on saying that the bust of housing would have no collateral damage to the rest of the economy because housing was only 5% of the GDP, not recognizing a good third of all jobs in the last 6 years have been created directly, indirectly through housing and finance and you name it. So the analysis was totally wrong. They didn't see this tsunami coming until the stuff hit the fan. And then once it hit the fan on August 9, 2007, too late, because by then over a year of unraveling of the housing, of the CDOs, of the subprime already occurred. And then, yeah, they started to get religion and they started cutting the Fed funds and creating some of the facilities. But even in that case, they've been always catching up with market and economic developments, always being one step behind the curve until they got really to zero interest rates and quantitative easing and unconventional stuff much more aggressively. So policymakers often make many mistakes of analysis, prognosis, diagnosis. Sometimes then they catch up, but you know, it's always a mixed bag.
I have one quick comment on the problem. Are you guys familiar with the Madoff story? Where the guy had 53 billion Ponzi scheme Madoff, right? If you're in part of a hedge fund and you come, because people don't do the diligence, and they did it on Madoff, and they come in with a piece of paper, a 400-page piece of paper, asking every possible question you can think of, including they want to know, and sometimes they do a crawl on you to figure out where you live, who you had dinner with, everything. They know, they have every possible piece of information about you. And Madoff, they did that, okay? Except the essential thing, that the guy was self-clearing. It was the same thing with the elephant in the room story. The government, they did every single analysis, and Greenspan missed out on the fact that banks were taking massive amount of tail risks via leverage, that the economy had, if you have three times the leverage, all right, you have probably 90 times the tail risk, you know, from effects, that if you have debt to GDP ratio, that simple information, nobody starts theorizing. The essential thing they did not see. Some people, many here, can see the obvious thing, and then the other people are beating around the bush with details and this and this and that and small details, nonsensical. This is a tragedy.
Rick, one comment. It's the policymakers, there's always going to be mistakes. And anybody here was on a policy thing, we would make mistakes too. So one question is, and I don't know the answer to this at all, the question to which one can have the policy world be a little more devolved. So if Alan Greenspan makes an error, there's some other policy areas that may not be in this domain. It may not be doable. I know in Canada and to a certain extent the U.S. and some other areas, provinces make policy decisions, and certainly we do have in the U.S. on some of the financial regulations, the state attorney generals play a role. So if Washington is doing nothing, there's possible alternatives. And then the one place I think, be it Greenspan, be it Ben Bernanke, whoever it is, they simply cannot be expected to think about, because they just don't have the time. They're reacting to crisis every second. And that is seeing what new sort of system or institutions you would want to develop to resolve the thing. They are there preserving, I think in large part, either positive or negative, but trying to preserve whatever there is. They can't say the truth. I think it's correct in some situations. They can't even, I think the truth. You can't be sitting there saying, it's going to be a disaster, And now how am I going to rebuild, or how should the country rebuild a disaster? That seems to me a job much more for academics, outside think tank people, and so on.
Well, the experience with financial regulation suggests that this policy devolution or decentralization doesn't work. You know, the U.S. was saying to the Brits, you know, your model of having only one regulator doesn't work because we have the competition among all our 50 or 6 federal ones, and better regulation is going to come out. And the reality of it is actually the opposite, that you have regulatory cherry picking. So you go and try to pick the one who is regulating you the least. It's almost like a race to the bottom, even among the regulators, about who's going to be slashing regulator the most. So that system of U.S. of having 6 federal regulators for the financial system and having 50 at the state level has been an utter disaster. I mean, there's a happy medium between having only one, like the FSA in the UK, and having 60 plus in the US. We've not yet figured out. Has that, again, to do with questions having also to do with regulatory capture and how you minimize regulatory capture. That's a very tricky issue.
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah, hi. My name is Rod Anderson. I'm a very retired chartered accountant. I have a quick question for Mr. Taleb, and I enjoyed the presentation, and it seems to me a useful day today. I confess I haven't read The Black Swan, but I will. My question was, you made the comment earlier on in writing that you wished all the scientists would keep out of this and get out of the real world and so on, and I just wondered if your view is still the same.
It's a little, when I spoke to him, I said that sometimes making something that's not scientific can lead to smoke, okay? So that name is called scientism. And when I told him I'm against scientism, he picked it up. And then he started talking technique, episteme, and I get the point. So my point is that science is something too serious, all right, to be given to poor scientists. You get my idea. I'd rather have nothing than poor science. Like, in economics, that's the problem we have. The more you see equations on a piece of paper, the more I can show you it's junk, all right? The more you see English words, the better it is, all right? That's pretty much, I mean, you can see it empirically, all right? It doesn't replicate, it has equations. So, but it's not always, but some, all right? It's like 95% of the cases. So this is how we solve this. But so when you attacked each other, we were, in fact, we discovered we're using the same language. We're against scientism, not against science.
Good. Bill Janeway?
Yeah, I just wanted, in the few minutes we have left, I'm going to have my shot this afternoon. I'd like you guys to get back to the fundamentals where Eric started, which is, what does this tell us, in your view, about foundations of economics and finance? And I appreciate, Nassim, you don't want to necessarily go down to the ergodic hypothesis, but in terms of, I mean, a lot of this, we've been talking about policy. Let's talk about the system and the underlying assumptions that have led to policy failure, not about the policy per se.
Well, I feel like I've probably had the best crack at that question, so I'd love to hear any of these three guys.
I tried to answer partly this question in my presentation by suggesting that, you know, we have to think about modeling disequilibrium rather than equilibrium, by modeling market failures, whether it's illiquidity or lack coordination problems in spending and aggregate demand, or coordination problem in the supply of credit when there is illiquidity or a credit crunch. We have to think about seriously incentive issues and how those agency problems affect economic behavior. We have to think about how to model more properly behavior under lack of rational expectations and bounded or whatever rationality. Those are the kind of number of the elements of the kind of core key issues that have been failures of the traditional equilibrium paradigm of economists. We have to think about, again, bubbles and lack of efficient markets and so on. I think if you can mix those things together, there's a fruitful way of thinking about economic behavior. Of course, you know, you have to think, as behavioral finance has done, about animal spirits and kind of and psychological elements in economic behavior as well.
There's a lot of work now in behavioral economics, which is bringing the psychology in so that one has a semi-rational person or whatever you want. And that's been very positive because one finds out exactly the areas where people are doing things that are not in their interest. And I think the more done there, that clearly will restrict certain abilities to exploit people. I think that I agree with the disequilibrium part because that's a real blunder in the heart of economics. I think the other blunder in the heart of economics is there's no place for networks or competing groups. And we don't, and this is a hard thing, I don't see physics as, I think it is much more in the biology. You're engaged in a fight with bacteria and you're, a good policymaker is trying to find medicine, but the bacteria are also getting, they're trying to survive too. And it does become an ecological system, as Eric sort of referred to the cheetah kind of thing. And that has been very hard to model and to analyze. But without that notion that you have elites form and they do certain things, you can't even understand the fear. And it's a fear a number of people have said now, that if this gets really bad, we will see right-wing populism, left-wing populism, anti-free trade things. Somebody said Lou Dobbs will be the next U.S. president. And that can be worse, as you may know some of our politicians. So it is this issue of not really dealing with groups and large groups, and large groups would now involve the banks that are too big to fail.
I think that you have a very big problem here, and let me tell you the problem. That when I hear someone saying modeling behavioral finance, modeling disequilibrium, and so on, and let me tell you, it's not an accident that we have assumption and rationality, and so on, because they provide unique solutions and for calibration purposes. It takes the inverse problem of a linear model. If I have dots on a page, there's one and only one minimally square line you can fit. And only one and minimum mean deviation can fit. So you have two possible models, okay, linear equations you can fit on a series of lines. If I mount nonlinear models, you have an infinity of models that can fit, each with an infinity of parameterization. All right. So there you go. So what I'm saying is that you have modeling equilibrium is very easy. Modeling disequilibrium, okay, let's not model. It's sort of exactly the same problem as we have from scale theory, all right? By saying that if you start having chaotic system, then it may look good on paper, all right, but small little parameterization blows up the thing, and the devil is in the details. It was too much devil in too many details. So that's my point. So it's not an accident that all these attempts, the three C's have failed, chaos, catastrophe, complexity, have failed. Chronically, people start again, they forget that has failed, they don't see the papers. There's a cemetery of so much research done in robust statistics and a lot of things that have not led anywhere. Why? Because you can't get results, you see. So this is where, let's come back to just use English, all right? Discuss things, use wisdom. Stay away from the episteme, go to techne. That's my point.
I can't think of a better person to come on next than Duane Farmer. We didn't think of the dramatic possibilities of this when we built.
He's going to talk about basins. That's what I was waiting for you to talk about.
I wanted to ask a question that would try and link the discussion on policy with a previous question about theory, and that is, and this is so particularly actually directed to Nouriel and Richard. If you think about, Summers and Bernanke and those guys, to me they sound very Keynesian in the things they're doing right now. And yet Keynes is not somebody who I have the impression is really seriously taught in most economics departments. He's viewed more as a part of economic history at this point. And yet, so my question is, what elements of economic theory, something they would read in a paper or teach their students, are Bernanke and Summers and so on actually using in a possibly productive way in the decision-making they're doing, as opposed to, say, analogies about Japan's last decade or World War II or historical analogs, which I actually admit are, I think, pretty useful here. But But what is economic theory actually, where is it giving us traction? I'm not asking the question rhetorically. I think there are some things, but I suspect they're subtle, but I'm just curious to take the positive side or the negative side. What have we learned in the last 20 or 30 years that actually is helping us right now?
Well, I think that, you know, we learned a lot both from economic theory and from those historical episodes of not just the Great Depression and Japan, but there have been dozens of systemic banking crises or financial crises in emerging markets. And as I try to point out, there are thousands of papers written by economists, both empirical and theoretical, modeling various aspects of currency banking, sovereign, household, corporate crises, and what are the causes of it, what was the role of policy, and how you resolve them. It's a whole, I would say, literature that gives you reasonable insights. For example, you know, I think the lesson of every recession, especially of great depressions in Japan, suggests, you know, the stock market crash of 1929 became a great depression because we didn't believe in counter-cyclical monetary policy. The monetary supply collapsed by 30% and interest rate did not fall, and that led to more severe recession. We didn't believe until 1936, because the general theory was written in 1936, in counter-cyclical fiscal policy. Private demand was collapsing, and there was no public demand. If anything, we were raising taxes and reducing government spending. It was this ideology of balanced budget that made the system even more fragile. There was the Schumpeterian ideal of creative destruction, market will cleanse themselves. That's not the case when you have market failure. So we let about 5,000 banks go bust, and the credit crunch became worse. And then, you know, by 33, 75% of households who had a mortgage had defaulted, and they were on the verge of foreclosure, you know, and that's the equivalent of liquidation for a firm with a major social and other cost. It was only when FDR came to power, we eased money supply, we stimulated fiscal policy, we created a social safety net, we created the RFC that recapitalized several thousand banks, allowed them to stay alive, and we created the HOLC that took the mortgages that were in default, reduced the face value, converted them to longer term, lower interest rates loans so that people could stay in their homes, and that was the beginning of a healing process. So that, together with economic theory, teaches you on how you deal with a situation in which there is one type of market failure, illiquidity, second market failure, credit crunch, third, aggregate demand, kind of lack, and what you need to do. In all of these cases, you need, unquote, benevolent monetary and fiscal easing and fixing the financial system so you don't have zombie banks and zombie agents in the economy. Those are the key things of what needs to be done. And we learned it, and probably because of that, we're going to avoid Japan and Great Depression. It's going to be an ugly, nasty recession. We're not going to end up in a Great Depression, hopefully. We're not going to end up like Japan.
I think there was a...
Richard, quick
there was a dual thing in economics, because Muriel spoke earlier about the real business cycle. So there was as we went through a period of great moderation, or you want to call it, a lot of effort, theoretical effort, was put into... basically equilibrium, a theory of equilibrium orientation. But I think when you went to actual studies, the empirical base, you cannot get away from these various crises and problems. And I think in their heart, I was struck, as you were, by how in the end, every economist, almost everyone, turned out to be a Keynesian when they saw a fire. So we can have all these theories about how the building is not going to burn down. The minute there was a fire, everybody jumped back. And it probably is a stronger thing to rely upon the historical and empirical evidence, which turned out to be very Keynesian.
Sample of one.
All these different crises that Nouriel laid out. You know, you have a number of different kinds of crises, and so it is the Great Depression gets heavily weighted in that sense, if you want to put this to Keynesian. But I do think that the theory was running off in one direction, and the sort of tacit knowledge, however the word you like, of everybody was, no, if there's a Great Depression, we're not going to be sitting here and saying it doesn't exist because my theory tells me no. And what we know is it does need some positive governmental interventions. Hopefully that they won't blow us up, those interventions.
Okay, on that note, I think we should thank our speakers and Richard for For a very exciting morning, and we will see everybody back here at 2:30. Thank you very much.